Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about a changing model of who we are as human beings. And I think a big part of that is an interaction with other beings, otherworldly beings. And within the short span of 50 or 60 years, there's been a whole history of people who've had direct interactions with these beings. And tonight's guest is probably one of the more well-known among those people. His name is Travis Walton. His story inspired Fire in the Sky. And welcome, Travis, to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Alan.
Yeah, I'm sort of surprised. Wasn't there a time where you weren't being so public with your story, and now you seem to be out more? What's gone on with you in the last few years in your relationship to this event?
Well, you know, it's been off and on for me over the years. When I very first, when it happened, you know, I tried to not do interviews, but I found out if I turned an interview down, it didn't make the story go away. It just made it more negative than it would be if I, you know, had my 2 cents worth in there. So I was kind of stuck with it. And but nevertheless, there's still been periods of time where I just kind of bowed out and didn't do interviews or, you know, accept invitations to speak or anything. But
yeah. No, that happened. So it's almost 40 years. You disappeared for 5 days aboard a craft, 1975, and it's all laid out in this movie, which I think you had some problems with. Can you talk a little bit about what you thought was the inconsistencies in how they presented your story?
Well, there's a certain amount of fictionalization that occurs in turning any real-life story into a movie. You know, there's kind of a structure that audiences really, you know, they don't accept anything less, but there's always other kinds of departures from reality that creep into it that I think are really unnecessary to go that far. And in my case, probably the ones I'd object to the most would be that which happened aboard the craft, whereas...
Oh, I see. What can you tell us what did happen aboard the craft?
Well, in the movie, they portray it as being very cluttered and organic, when in reality it was very sterile and mechanical looking inside.
Mm-hmm.
They even changed the appearance of the beings themselves, with the rationale that, hey, we've got beer commercials with these type of beings in there, and so we want to show the audience something they haven't seen before. Never mind that that's not the way they looked.
Well, how would you describe how they looked from your personal experience?
Well, they were very small beings, you know. That didn't reduce my fear of the circumstances I was in, but, you know, they were about 4 feet tall, large heads, hairless, very large eyes, but... You know, in a humanoid, to me, means two arms, two legs, you know, a head on top with two eyes. That's what humanoid means. You know, a lot of people confuse that to mean that a humanoid means human-looking or resembling humans, but that's not what the word means.
It's pretty amazing, though, that this happened, 38 or almost 40 years ago, and it's still... a big part of your life. I mean, how do you feel about that?
It's really kind of strange, you know. It's been a dawning, sort of a gradual growing awareness with me that, along with the burden of having had this happen to me, you know, is a certain responsibility to try to make something good come up, because, you know, running away from it ain't going to work. It's I'm stuck with it. It's going to be there. So it's kind of odd how it's grown over the years. You know, weekend before last, I did an interview for Russian television, and that was the first. And there's a tour group coming from China. And I'm getting emails from farther corners of the world now than ever before. And it's like it took on a life of its own.
Well, I think it's becoming more acceptable. I also want to say that Travis will be at the Joshua Tree Retreat Center on August 9th to the 11th for a big Contact in the Desert conference, where many people who are, I would say, scholars and really investigated the validity of these of this phenomena will be there. People like Richard Dolan, who I also saw in Washington, D.C., appear in front of former members of Congress. I guess you can feel like you're not alone anymore in this phenomenon.
Oh, yeah. Things have changed dramatically over the years. You know, back when this happened, there wasn't any support groups at all. There were a few UFO organizations, but nothing like there is today. And, you know, back when this happened, they didn't really know for certain of a single planet outside of this solar system. Astronomers had theories, but, you know, it wasn't until Hubble and Kepler that they've actually identified which stars have planets and which ones might be Earth-like. And, you know, the routineness that space travel, the shuttle, and all that gained over the years has sort of changed the consciousness of the people on this world.
Yeah, and I think we eventually, who knows, maybe we'll openly meet these beings that you met. Do you think that's possible?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, and when they talk about disclosure and some kind of openness about this, I don't think it's going to happen by virtue of popular demand or pressure, although, you know, all those efforts are something I applaud. It's part of it, I think, is that we're not ready, and that to have that happen would be extremely disruptive. I think these entities are aware of that, and that's their motivation for being so clandestine in their activities here, and it's probably at least part of the motivation of the government in keeping what they know under wraps.
Well, that's actually the big part of the thing I want to talk to you about. The thing that I read in your book and other places you've said it, you didn't feel threatened by these beings physically, but there was something about being in their presence which was so traumatic. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, when they came around the table and I was screaming and making threatening motions at them, they stopped, but they stared into me with this disturbing, invasive sort of feeling that, you know, I didn't understand for a long time. But more recently, I've begun to think that perhaps if they were trying to assert some kind of control over me, it wasn't working at that point. But the feeling of that it gave me when they were trying it, it was what bothered me so much about, and why the stare that they were giving me was the substance of my nightmares after I was returned.
Well, it was a substance of your nightmares because you felt like your mind was being invaded with something
that? You know, and you know, after I was returned, I was given a brainwave scan, and I was put under assumed name, and the technician didn't know anything except to look for signs of injury. And he noted in his report an odd brainwave pattern. And I'm thinking that if that was some kind of an after effect of having been hit by the energy of that beam, that may have disrupted the neural circuits in a way that prevented them from controlling me. But nevertheless, just the attempt felt so invasive. I don't know what else to describe it.
Well, you know, that beam that hit you sounds a lot like the beam that hit Jim Pendison at the Bentwaters case. Have you looked into that case at all?
I've heard a little bit about it, but I really don't look into other cases. But, you know, one of the guys on the crew, Dwayne Smith, became a journeyman electrician after he left that job we were on then. And he said that to him it sounded like the high voltage he has worked around. And whatever the energy was, it was extremely powerful.
So you went towards the craft and you were zapped.
Yeah. And, rather than it being a beam that was fired, I'm now thinking most likely it was just the fact that when I straightened up to run away, I brought my upper body closest to it, and some kind of discharge, like a static spark, you know, on a giant scale, jumped through me to the ground. And then they were forced to take me aboard to try to revive me.
Well, they could have left you there, though, right?
Yeah, but the crew, you know, didn't know CPR, and the hospital was an hour away. So I'd have been dead had they not taken me aboard.
So you're saying the aliens really saved your life in that way?
Yeah, I'm you know, and it took a long time to come to that realization. But the fact that I was returned to a place where I could get help, again, says something about their concern for my survival.
Oh, I get that. Now, when you were on board, and you probably say this a lot, how conscious were you? Because a lot of people talk about abductions in a sort of dreamlike awareness. I mean, I think even I had whatever contact, but I wasn't conscious. I wasn't awake. Were you pretty...
Well, yeah, you know, the normal situation is they induce some kind of a trance-like state, but in my case, if my brain was kind of scrambled by this energy, you know, it sort of circumvented that process, and so I was in a very keenly aware state, you know, fueled by fear and adrenaline. There was nothing trance-like about it.
So that I think is what makes your case so unique and so different than, you know, probably the thousands of others that are out there, is that most people are not that lucid and clear in these states. And was the fear because all of a sudden you were in a totally new environment and you had no idea what was happening?
Well, you know, that could be some of it, but you know, when I gained consciousness, I immediately felt the need for air. I felt like I was suffocating. And nothing generates panic more than the feeling of suffocation. And, you know, you combine that with the pain and this claustrophobic, dimly lit little room I was in, all that, you know, with feeling trapped and having these beings so close to me, it just combined to you know, cause me to lose it.
Wait, so when you were feeling like you were suffocating, then how did they give you oxygen then? Or
no, I was, you know, lashing out and fighting their approach to me, so they were unable to give me any kind of support in that way. And whether my struggling to breathe was caused by some lingering injury from being hit by the beam or whether the atmosphere in there was not correct, you know, the feeling of suffocation, you know, causes panic in a way that you just can't reason away.
Yeah, no, I know. And so you have that panic, but then eventually how did you relax into, or you weren't panicked for 5 days though, right?
No, they rendered me unconscious in a short period of time, and whatever happened there, I'm not able to get at after all this time.
Wow. So are there still pieces though that come to you even 40 years later?
Little fragments.
But you don't remember all 5 days on board the ship then?
Right.
How much of it do you remember?
You know, I've estimated that period of time to be, you know, around an hour. It's really hard to estimate time when you're hysterical, but it was just a small part of the time, and that's the reason when I was returned, I thought it was still the same night rather than 5 days and 6 hours later.
Oh, so you don't know if they must have fed you or something, right?
Yeah,
you know
they must have, because there wasn't signs of starvation. Although there was some mild dehydration.
I see. So they returned you at you. When did the incident happen? During in the afternoon or
the evening of November 5th, and then you know 5 days and 6 hours later, around midnight.
Right, and so we don't have to go into the whole story about how your crew was like suspected of having murdered you and all that. I mean, I'm more interested in the actual event on board the ship and the interactions with these beings. Like, do you feel like you were given some special information because of your interaction somehow?
Well, if they did, I don't have it yet.
But you do have something, because you are coming out and saying, this is real, and we got to wake up to this. I mean,
yeah, I think it's important for people to increase their awareness of this situation. But the fact that it was less of an abduction and more of an ambulance call is an important point, because I think there's quite a bit too much fear built up around this. I think that whole belief could lead to an improper reaction should more open contact occur.
But there are, there are abduction cases, I'm sure, but the fear, I think, is just because it's so bizarre.
Yeah.
So how would you, though, help people get used to the idea? I don't know if you want to call it that, or at least not have that fear. I mean, what would you say to people?
Well, you would think that with their technology, that if they really wanted to remain completely hidden from our perception that they're here, that could be accomplished. I think the reason it's just kind of marginal and just it's kind of like they're just feeding a little bit to sort of get people used to the idea in a way that's going to be the least disruptive, the least shocking to society.
Right, that's what I think. They come and they go, and people say, did you see that? And they say, no. And then, and it's like the government is doing sort of the same thing. They release information, and then they deny it.
The net effect is eventually people will become more acclimated to the idea. But in some regards, there's a lot of the people on this planet that are really living in basically Stone Age conditions, I mean, so there's a huge percentage of the population that get their water from the river or the lake and build fires to cook their meals every day and don't have central heating and cooling and that sort of thing.
Do you think, are you saying that whether they're here or not wouldn't matter to those people or could it?
Well, what I mean is that, we pride ourselves on the fact that we went to the moon. Well, we didn't go to the moon. A segment of our population, had the technological ability to achieve that. And there's a lot of people that Jay Leno interviews on the street who don't have a clue.
Right. But I guess, if they have this incredible technology, and obviously they do because you're one of the few people who can verify that they've been on, then why don't they give us this technology so they don't have to have these people? I mean, I have my own ideas why they don't, but why do you think they don't?
Well, where do I begin as far as disruption is concerned, I really think, it might be kind of quaint or whatever to think of a non-interference directive like they have in science fiction, that there's basically a rule that you don't come and disrupt the development of less developed societies because it is harmful. And, to just plop some advanced technology down in the midst of us would really create havoc. It's not going to help. And, we have to improve our understanding and our maturity as a species in a variety of ways before we're ready for the technology. The technology is something that can just be misused if you're not, up to speed in the other areas that we really need to, evolve in.
Well, yeah, and I mean, are these new ideas for you? In 1975, I know we all change over the course.
Yeah, well, I've had 38 years to try to think of why, what, where, and what. So I can't say that I've gone too far with it, but, I have, I'm a long ways from where I was back when it first happened.
I mean, fundamentally, you've changed because of this in ways you couldn't have imagined.
Yeah, it's beyond measure. I know that in no way am I who I would have been had this never happened.
Are you happy it happened then?
No, there's still most of me that just says, I wish I'd have stayed in the truck and this had never happened.
Right. If you stayed in the truck like the other guys, you wouldn't have been blasted, and you wouldn't have.
Wouldn't. This never would have happened.
You've become a spokesperson for this other level of reality, and maybe it was supposed to, I don't know, supposed to, but maybe, you know, this was a bigger calling for you, and
I hope to figure out what my role was supposed to be here, but I'm going to do my best to try to make something good come of it, to just sort of raise the bar in terms of understanding and people's approach to it and, you know, how to evaluate these kinds of reports.
Well, I think you've made a huge difference just because of all the incidences around the case. I mean, it was confirmed that you were missing for 5 days. They couldn't find you anywhere. And I think just that gives a validity in human terms that there's something real that's happening here.
Yeah, well, here we are, you know, all these years later, all of the crew stands by what happened, and at the time when they were accused of murdering me and they passed a police polygraph test, the president of the Polygraph Association said that the odds were 1,000,000 to 1 of there being any mistake with those tests, but now there's 16 passed tests, five of them are mine, So, you know, who knows what the odds would be now. But there's a whole lot more to it, you know, evidence found at the site and that kind of thing that each and every theory that the naysayers put forth has just been, you know, methodically, you know, debunked.
Oh, I didn't know there were – what kind of stuff was found at the site that you were blasted at?
Well, they found some anomalous magnetic readings. They found traces of radiation, the trees nearest to where the craft came down grew at an accelerated rate for, you know, years and years after it happened.
And this was near Snowflake, or where was this exactly?
Well, it was up on the rim near Heber, Arizona, which is, you know, 30 miles from Snowflake.
Do you ever go back to that place and just kind of...
As little as possible, but, you know, I have been back there.
Uh-huh.
I need to go have an expedition here this summer in which some of the follow-up research needs to be done.
Oh, so you're going to go back there this summer, huh?
Yeah, you know, I can get a crew and some researchers to, you know, just to look into some of those effects that I was just describing to you, see if they're still there and maybe some tests that haven't been done yet.
I mean, there's so many people that I meet, and it's so frustrating for me to have people think that UFOs, aliens, they're not real, they're made up. I mean, how do we convince these people that this stuff is real?
Well, I think, you know, there's probably no simple way to just, you know, overcome all of their objections, because a lot of it has to do with what they prefer to believe, but, mm-hmm. you know, one by one, you just have to, you know, point out the problem with their approach to things. Some of them have religious objections. Some of them, you know, have heard rumors. And see, a lot of the naysayers, the debunkers, have thrown out a lot of theories that, even though they were disproven almost immediately, they've survived all this time. The skeptics latch onto those things and put them on the Internet to this day. Like, for instance, that I passed a polygraph test because I just believe it happened. It was really just a drug hallucination. But the fact that I had blood and urine samples put through the county medical examiner's drug screen, which proved there was no drugs of any kind in my body, you know, that's been known all these years, and yet the skeptics, you know, grab onto that as one of their propaganda pieces.
Well, are they skeptical because it's just so hard to believe, or are they fearful that their reality, and this is what I think, is not what we say it is?
Yeah, I agree with you that it's really based in fear.
Yeah. Because if we think that the reality we've been conditioned to believe isn't what we say it is, then sort of our whole ego identification falls apart. in some sense, right?
Yeah, and once they've said, oh, this can't be, then they kind of get entrenched and feel defensive, and they do everything they can to shore up that previous conclusion. It's then becomes, don't confuse me with the facts. They want to shut out any kind of opposing view. And also, I think it's a kind of an error in the reasoning pattern they're using. They tend to equate the unproven as disproven. In other words, they're not going to believe anything as true unless it's proved. And if it's not proved, then that's the equivalent of disproven for them.
Well, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of pictures and eyewitness accounts and photographs. When I've been looking at the skeptics' blogs, and they say they want physical proof. So is that the only way? Even then, I bet they wouldn't, acknowledge.
No, they wouldn't. But, you know, there's many, many things in our day-to-day lives that we take for granted that we don't really have physical proof of. Physical evidence of, we just go on as if it's true because, you know, that's the only thing that makes sense.
Like, what are you talking about?
Simple things. Like, if I go over to that door, I open it before I go through it. You know, I don't need proof that if I just try to walk through that doorway, I'm not going to make it unless I open the door first. But, you know, an arch skeptic approaches that kind of thinking, and that, you know, everything has to be proven. You know, the existence of air, gravity, and magnetism, things that you can't see are nevertheless there.
Right. And, you know, just meeting you, I mean, if people, and they're all over the place, is saying that these things don't exist. Just by meeting you and hearing your story, the fact that, you know, you are telling the truth, how can people then still deny what's true?
I don't know. You know, if you truly want to know what is, you don't have strong feelings about what you want it to be. Yeah. You have to take the truth for what it is, whatever it turns out to be. And to be totally willing to accept the truth, whatever it is, you have to examine the facts impartially rather than picking and choosing the things that support the view you held before.
Well, you know what I think? If and when these beings become part of our world, there's something about them, that, and maybe you can tell me, that changes who we are. Like, in their presence, of course you were kind of, you know, traumatized, but did you feel, like, different in a sense?
Oh, yeah. You know, it just changed the perspective in terms of, you know, being, you know, earth-centric and being preoccupied with the day-to-day things. And it really did change my perspective in terms of the wider existence. It's just a fact. Just in the last year, NASA came out and said, it's a virtual certainty that there are more planets in the Milky Way than there are stars. Mm-hmm. We knew there were billions of stars, but now with the telescopes and the statistical sampling that they've done so far, they can say that there's more planets than there are stars. And that's a huge number of worlds other than our own. And you just can't assume that those things are just empty out there. That's absurd thinking.
And life, I think, the proliferation of life is a natural phenomenon in the universe. It everywhere.
And, you know, the skeptics are very fond of saying, well, we don't know of anything with our understanding of physics of a practical way for them to get here from there or for us to get from here to there. But, you know, Michio Kaku made the point on television here a while back that people keep envisioning these other worlds to be 100 or 1,000 years ahead of us. But he said, based on the age of these systems, they can be hundreds of thousands or millions of years ahead of us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's technologically, it's just so silly for people to make pronouncements about what's possible. I mean, learned scientists in just 100 years ago were saying man could never have traveled faster than 60 miles an hour because all the air would be sucked away and you'd be suffocated. Just, you know, silly things that, you know, some of the best thinkers of the day believed at the time.
Right. They talked about it was impossible to have heavier-than-air machines when after the Wright brothers flew. I mean, and just look at the iPhone, the cell phone. There's more components in that than was in a whole room full of hardware in the 1940s. So technology isn't the obstacle. I think it's more the consciousness, how we deal with these beings when we're no longer, like you said, Earth-centric. And that's the change we need to come to.
Yeah, for sure. I agree.
And so I just want to know, when you were interacting, you said they penetrated your mind with their thoughts. Is that, I mean, if we were to interact with these beings as if they arrive, would that be the trauma for people that they are like, you know, not just strange looking, but they have a different way of thinking, is guess what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, well, you know, it might be that was an extreme measure that they needed to initiate because I was a bull in a china shop and was, you know, a threat to myself and to them. And it might be that just good etiquette would make it to where they didn't do those kinds of invasive things if we had a more open sort of interaction with them.
But what do you think these people, these beings are like? I mean, because you know, were firsthand there. I mean, they don't make small talk. I mean, what do they do with themselves? Or is it like impossible to know?
Well, we don't know at this point, but I think a lot of that had to do with they were trying to keep me from knowing as little, you know, as possible about them, you know? The reason they wouldn't speak, the reason they wouldn't respond to my questions, all that, you know, the lack of any written signs or signals, you know, that I think they might have been sort of hiding that.
What do you think they would be hiding if they were, like, what could you imagine?
Well, I can imagine at least that if they were speaking English, there might be an accent or, you know, or lack of accent or you know, who knows? It would just be that much more to think about. If you were just trying to save someone from themselves, so to speak, with the minimal amount of intrusion, silence would have naturally be, you know, one of the first steps.
Right. But do you think, have you ever been hypnotized to all those missing hours and days? Do you think there's more in your subconscious that you're not aware of that you might know?
Yeah. But, you know, I've been afraid to try to get at that because there was a warning during the first hypnosis session about trying to push past that. Now, whether that was a bluff or not, I'm not going to test.
But what was that warning? How'd that come up?
I would die if they tried to get to the memories other than what I was recalling when I was returned. And so there's a possibility, you know, that Dr. Harder shied away from pushing further with that because if I were to be regressed back to a period of time in which I was in cardiac arrest, you might actually cause that cardiac arrest to reoccur. Like if the energy of that beam just stopped my heart or something, you know, you don't want to pass through that time period hypnotically.
Oh, so did that actually come up as a warning in your hypnosis?
No, I'm speculating there, but the warning was specific, but nothing about cardiac arrest.
But what was the warning? So you were hypnotized.
I already said I would die if they tried to go past that block.
You said that. It came out of you. Is that?
Yeah, during the hypnosis.
I see. So, or you're saying that may just be an implant from them to prevent you from going and finding out who deep more truth about it, right?
Yeah.
But you don't want to risk that, and I understand, you know, that what if they regressed you after the beam, after they revived you, because you're saying that just happened and that you regressed to, like, the last day on board, the last 2 days. Would that be something you were willing to try or probably not?
No, I'm not That's playing with fire. It's just,
yeah.
You know, little bits of it come back now and then, and I guess if it's meant to be, I don't know. I may never know.
Well, do you think they're here for? Well, what reason do you think they are here? Were they there in Arizona at that time?
Well, you know, people are constantly referring to the alien agenda, like as if there's just one group of aliens and they have one set purpose. But I don't think that's the case. I think that even where the descriptions that are being lumped into various types, you know, the reptilians, the Nordics, the Greys, are really broad categories that include probably, in my view, species that don't even come from the same planet at all, that they just happen to look similar, so they get lumped together.
But what you saw, would you call it a gray, the beings that interact with you?
No, that term didn't exist in 1975. It generally fits the description of large eyes and bald head and small stature compared to ours. But the variations in descriptions that you get there might be because they just happen to come from planets, different planets, and happen to look a lot alike.
Or maybe we're all related in some humanoid sort of way.
That's a possibility, too.
Mm-hmm. But how many did you see when you were on board?
Two different types.
Two different types. And what was the difference between the two?
Well, one type looked like what people keep calling grays, but the others looked like humans.
Oh, but did they look exactly human, or was there something odd about them?
No, a little bit, but they'd pass in a crowd.
Oh, I didn't realize that. And what were they wearing? Were they wearing like...
Well, the humans or the other ones?
Well, the little grays, what were they wearing?
They were just wearing a kind of a coverall.
Like a one-piece jumpsuit type thing?
Yeah.
And the humans, were they dressed differently?
Yeah, they were dressed differently. They were wearing a more tightly fitting coverall. That's what made me think that they were, at first, that they were like from Air Force or something, like some kind of a flight suit or something like that. It was just a blue uniform, but no insignia, no flags or anything like that.
Oh, so it's a blue kind of one-piece sort of flight suit that the humans were wearing.
Yeah.
And the other ones were wearing sort of a similar thing like that, too?
Yeah, only it was orangish, brownish-orange.
Oh, it was brownish-orange. And the humans were wearing a darker sort of suit, huh?
Right, blue.
And like sort of like a dark blue, navy blue sky, or light blue? So what was the relationship between those, like, E.T.-looking ones and the humans? Do you know?
Well, that's a subject of speculation because, you know, it might have been that the little ones didn't understand my physiology and needed help from someone that was more similar to me. Mm. It might be that there was a forceful intervention. The human type was taken me back from the smaller ones. It might have been some sort of cooperative thing all along. Who knows? You know, there's a variety. Some people even think that maybe this human-looking type was just something they created on short notice to get control of me.
I've heard that. They generate these, like, human-type looking things to make you the person feel comfortable.
Yeah.
But were they male or female?
Well, they were mostly male, but there was one female.
Uh-huh.
She had longer hair than they did, which seems kind of Earth-like, but I don't know, maybe that's...
What color was her hair, would you say?
It was light-colored. It wasn't real blonde. It wasn't platinum blonde, but it was lighter.
And were the men lighter too, with blue eyes or dark eyes or?
Well, there was something odd about their eyes that was just. That's probably the distinguishing feature that I would pick out if I was to see them walking around on Earth.
What was the odd thing about their eyes?
I never could quite figure out what that was. It was just something I couldn't quite put my finger on.
Well, you think those humans could be in the hybrids of aliens and human offspring?
They didn't bear any similarity to the other creatures.
Oh, I see. Were they telepathic too, the way you say that those little ET beings?
I didn't pick up anything like that.
So did you have any interaction with these human-looking beings?
Well, they took me out of there and rendered me unconscious. But, during the period of time that I recalled, I was just screaming questions and pretty hysterical, but they didn't respond to my, desperate begging for answers about what was happening to me and,
It would be interesting to kind of get you back. I mean, of course, I understand the hesitation, but it'd be interesting to know what else happened to you on board that ship. I mean, aren't you curious in a way to know that?
Yeah, curious and fearful at the same time. And
right.
If there was a way to find out and be completely safe, I would, of course, opt for that, but I don't know whether I'd go public with it. People say, oh, it's so great that you came forward, but I didn't come forward. By the time I was returned, this was world news, and I tried to avoid talking about it publicly, but, it's something that they came to me.
I mean, I think it's great how your crew is really now standing behind you, and I guess because they were freaked out too for a long time, weren't they?
Oh yeah, they definitely were. It had a profound effect on all of us.
Wow, it's somehow it seems sort of destined, maybe if you want to call it that. I mean, how did this affect your religious beliefs at all? I'm just curious.
Well. I don't think that, a lot of people imagine it would just blow your religious thoughts away, but I see absolutely no contradiction between what happened and in any religion. Because, I could go get into that, but,
Get into it a little bit, because there's still, like, the source, the creator, whatever you want to call it, that generates life, I guess, right?
Yeah. I've had people come to me from various religions, Muslim, Jewish, various Christian religions, and they'll either say, this contradicts my religion, I can't believe that, or this fits right in with this, this, and this that I believe. And, they're from the same religion, and so it's just a matter of personal interpretation. I've said before that when you get right down to it, there's 7 billion different religions here on Earth, we kind of group ourselves into denominations, but everyone basically has their own religion, and they interpret things the way they want to in a very personal way.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Yeah, exactly. Two Christians, two Roman Catholics will not believe the same thing, even though they call themselves the same religion. So,
yeah.
But I just think the appearance of these beings worldwide does shake things up in a way that change. It's what Bud Hopkins used to say, it is the biggest event in history. Is the realization that we're not alone. It's in the way that Copernicus said, the Earth isn't the center of the universe. It has a positive effect on people.
Yeah, and, that was earth-shattering concept back then, to the point where Galileo was placed under house arrest and threatened with death for even suggesting that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. But, times change, and, the same church that said that has come out here in the last few years and said there's absolutely nothing wrong with believing that there are other life out there.
But then the people that really make the policy, the government, there was just something Obama said, no, there's no proof that we've been visited by, or his White House did, that by other beings. There's another type of orthodox religion in place. The scientific world that...
Well, that phrase, there is no proof, sometimes there is proof and they're just denying it, and other times the fact that there's no proof is irrelevant to the idea that it's probably pretty likely to be true. It just hasn't been proven yet. Like I said, lack of proof is not disproof.
Right.
The unproven is not disproven.
That's right. That's a really key. And there's and also someone like you who's had the experiences, you know. You don't need, I mean.
I know personally, and that kind of makes me feel set apart in a way in many times. But, you know, the other side of the coin of that belief thing with the skeptic is the gullible, the person that believes everything that's not absolutely disproven. And that's not a valid way of thinking either. There are many things in the vast continuum between disproven and proven that we have to just assign a certain degree of weight to. You know, there's a certain amount of evidence that points in that direction. And, you know, we just have to go forward without absolute proof. Even our court system fails to recognize that someone who is found not guilty has not been proven innocent.
Mm.
That's different.
Right. No, I think that's a really good point. You know, I think the scariest thing about meeting these beings is realizing that we're not the smartest creatures in the universe. Don't you think there's a little bit of that out there?
Oh, yeah. That comes with that whole Earth-centric sort of point of view. You know, we're it. We're just all there is. You know, the idea that something might be above us is threatening, especially to those in leadership positions who like to see themselves as the elite of creation.
Right. It's threatening, but it's also very sobering, I think, in a bigger picture. You know how kind of grounds us. It's like, okay, well, we're just part of the food chain, and we sort of need to take responsibility then for our planet and ourselves and our interactions. I mean, it's a game changer. This is what I'm saying.
But, you know, each of us is born rather simple. I mean, when we're kids, we don't know too much about the world. And as we progress through our lives, we gain understanding and wisdom. And, you know, our whole younger years is immersed in the idea that there are people who know more than us who are running things, and someday we might be that rise to that level, but at this point we're not. So it's a continuum, and so it shouldn't be so shocking that as a species there's somebody that's farther along than us, since we each of us begin our lives that way, looking at adults as, you know, those people who know more than us.
Actually, that's a really good point. I'm glad you said that, because you're right. It's just sort of the natural order of things. But something happens with this scientific elite and the government, especially the U.S. government, where they want to be on top of it all. They want to maintain control, and that's what I think is the biggest threat.
Yeah, that's certainly a big part of it. But even if that didn't exist, the fact that they have been denying it officially for so long, as they backed themselves into the corner, it's very hard for them to come out and say, okay, we've been lying to you for years, but now we're going to tell you the truth. You know, they would undermine their own credibility in a dramatic way that they're just not about to do unless they're forced to.
Well, I think they might be forced to at some point.
I don't think it's going to be marches in the street or petitions. I think most likely it will be one of two things. A whistleblower who comes out and you know, runs off some documents or something, or more likely, just some big event that they can't deny. You know, a crash that occurs in a populated or near populated area, that kind of thing.
But they had that. Did you see that video Richard Dolenz did with that old guy who worked for the CIA who went to investigate Area 51 for Eisenhower, and he comes back to Eisenhower, he talks to Eisenhower, Nixon, and Hoover, and says, yes, there are aliens and crashed UFOs at Area 51. He tells Eisenhower that, and he He's just come out on a video, and so there are whistle. Did you see that video?
No.
On you? You did. So, but anyway, those whistleblowers don't seem to change anything because.
Oh yeah, like I said, it has to be a whistleblower that takes some proof with him because, you know, they're very good at covering up this kind of stuff. The government is very aware of a basic technique that they can fool most of the people most of the time, and that's quite sufficient to their purposes.
Mm-hmm. I just want to ask you another question. Did you, after you returned, I know you said you had nightmares. Did you feel like you were being communicated in some way by these beings after?
Yeah, I think that just those nightmares were just the post-traumatic stuff that I was just dreaming things that were waking me up.
So you never felt any more mental invasion from these beings after you returned?
No.
I see. So they kind of like disconnect. Would you be interested in meeting them again or not?
Well,
really?
You know, brainwave pattern that I was talking about that I speculated might be what gave me resistance to their mental invasion. One of the things I wanted to follow up on was to have another EEG and see if that effect was still there.
And you haven't had that at all?
No.
Well, that should be pretty easy to arrange, actually.
Yeah. So that's something I'd like to get accomplished, see if that odd pattern is still there.
That would be interesting. So at this event coming up in August, you're going to be speaking there, and in the promotion for that, you said you had some new kind of material or ideas that you were going to talk about?
Well, I think it's, you know, piecing together things more than, you know, just not some dramatic new revelation, but just a new understanding and kind of putting the puzzle together in a way that makes sense.
Like what would you say? I mean, can you...
I've touched on some of those kinds of things now, you know, equating, you know, this to be more of an ambulance call than an abduction. And then there's some whole litany of material to do with government cover-up and suppression and that sort of thing.
Would you be willing to testify in front of, like, Congress if you were asked to?
Yeah, but I don't think they're interested in hearing from me.
Well, I mean, Steve, you know, Stephen Bassett put together this whole thing in April, but I think he would do it again, even with contactees. People have had some kind of personal experience with these beings. You didn't see any writing on the craft, any letter-type writing, did you?
No, I didn't see any writing.
So the inside was completely sort of sterile and sort of like a misty kind of light, huh? Is that what you said?
Well, you know, there were metallic surfaces and, you know, just plain surfaces. If there were any kind of signs or insignia, they may have just removed them just for temporarily because of my presence.
Well, the other thing is, you must, obviously, the craft must have been traveling because the craft wasn't there where they found you 5 days.
Right.
Did you go?
I was thinking that if I could open a door, I could jump out and I'd still be in the woods, but obviously that was not the case because, you know, it wasn't still there. The crew came back and saw it leave, and so they, you know, it was not.
But did you have any sense of you were out in space or anything like that?
It could have been, but I didn't feel motion. Mm-hmm. It was just like being in a building or something, very motionless, and I didn't hear the sounds of machinery from the inside like I did from the outside. It was making a terrific, powerful sound from the outside, but it was
like
silent on the inside.
What did it sound like exactly?
It was a cyclic frequency kind of a thing across the whole range of human hearing. Some of it was very bass, very low, that they could feel in the truck, and I could feel in my body more than hear. And some of it was high-pitched off the range of human hearing on the other end.
Did it feel like it was kind of going through you, the sound?
Yeah, you felt it as much as hearing it.
And you heard that before, and then you got out of the truck and you ran towards it. Why did you do that?
Well, you know, Alan and Steve said it looked to them like I was in a trance, but you know, it didn't feel that way to me. Now, if they were controlling me at that point, you know, they could make me think it was my idea, I suppose, but the entrancement was that I was just in awe of the power, and it was, this thing was so shiny and so, you know, giving off this glow, this energy. It was just astonishing. That's the way all of us felt. And so, you know, we were all in awe to that extent.
So it was, you felt like, and I believe you, you wanted to just get a little closer to this thing. That was what your feeling was.
Yeah.
I probably would have done the same thing. I mean, it's like, wow, there's this amazing thing. Let's check it out, right?
Yeah, well, the closer I got, the scareder I got. And part of that was the closer I got, the more the crew was screaming and swearing at me to get back, you know.
And then you got, how close were you before you were zapped?
Well, there was this pile of logging and tree trunks and stuff there that kept me from getting much closer. But
right.
I was looking up probably at about a 45 or more when it suddenly got louder, started to move.
You were 45 feet away, about 40 feet
away?
No,
that was 45 degrees.
Oh, I see. And how many
the
feet?
Angle I was looking at.
And how far were you from it, would you say?
Well, I was pretty dang close, you know. But so that when I went into a crouch and then decided to run back to the truck, when I stood up, that's when my upper body was closest to it, the closest thing to it. And that's what made that energy jump like a spark.
Were you, what, like 5 feet from it or 10 feet? Or?
No, it was more like 10 or 15 feet, you know.
Oh, I see. So something jumped off the craft. Was the craft hovering or was it actually on the ground?
It was hovering.
It was hovering, and it looked saucer-shaped, the kind of like... And it was metal, you're saying?
Yeah, metallic and glowing at the same time.
Was there windows that you could look in or no windows?
There weren't windows. There were just like panels or sections that glowed.
Uh-huh. Glowed with like what color light?
Sort of a golden glow.
So it must have been quite spectacular to see it. I mean,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, it was. It was astonishing. That's something that all of the crew talks about, you know, that it was just this amazingly powerful thing.
Wow, it's strange. I wonder what they were doing in the middle of the woods. I mean, what would you think that craft was doing out there?
Well, there's all kinds of speculation. You know, some people have given me maps of various geological and geothermal and kinds of things that were there. And the summer after this happened, there was a lady that was working in the lookout tower, the fire lookout tower nearby, and she said that this crew of federal workers came through and they were measuring magnetic readings. And they were using these instruments on the ground, which, you know, my understanding is normally this is done by airplane. They just fly over with this thing hanging below it, and they do make those kind of measurements from the air. But I'm thinking that maybe they were there following up on the report that the ufologists had published, you know, about going to the site and finding these unusual magnetic readings where the craft came down.
Oh, I bet they were, huh? So when you go back there this summer, are you going to take instruments to do more magnetic readings?
Yes, that's the plan.
I see. That should be interesting. So,
see, when we went back with National Geographic, they were going to follow up on the radiation readings, but their insistence on going when there was 2 feet of snow on the ground just completely blew that out of the water, because water shields radiation. So there's no way you could tell if there was radiation down below that snow.
That's kind of stupid that they would do that, you know.
Yeah.
Wonder why they did that. Maybe they didn't want to know, really, right?
Well, I think they didn't want to know, but it wasn't like they cared whether there was snow or not. It was just that You know, National Geographic has a tremendous reputation for doing nature and science documentaries, and so I was really excited that this follow-up testing, you know, mm-hmm. on a variety of fronts would achieve something. They mm-hmm. flew a scientist in there that they never used. They took samples that were never tested, and it was just basically a big joke. So National Geographic has no credibility on the subject of UFOs.
Wait, what was the theme? Was this particularly your case, or was it about UFOs in general?
Well, they had a series called Chasing UFOs, and mine was one whole episode of it.
Oh, so, yeah, it sounds like they were just trying to debunk the whole thing, really,
well,
right?
Well, not really. It was just a big who cares, ha-ha kind of a, you know, they just weren't taking it serious, you know.
Yeah, I think that's the problem with the media, is that, you know, because they kind of dictate the mindset of the public. If they don't take it seriously, you can't expect the general public to take it seriously. And
well, after I left, they put on these cameras, these night vision cameras. But instead of them pointing out there at the things in the sight, they were pointed at their own faces. So they could just be running around, breathing hard, and looking all panicked. And it was just silly. You know, they say, what's that noise? Oh, there's a bear out there.
Yeah,
no, there wasn't. Like I said, there was 2 feet of snow, and bears are hibernating. But, you mm-hmm. know, they tried to just make a scary little thing at the tagline at the end of it that was just silly. And, you know, it was a regrettable experience. But
And the movie was actually, I thought, a good, convincing portrayal, even though they may have gotten some of the details wrong, but it did seem...
Well, there's been dozens of productions over the years, and the movie included, but the most accurate one that was ever done was that 90-minute special that the Sci-Fi Channel did on Paranormal Witness.
Oh, you were the star of that one? Did they focus
on
your case?
Yeah, they did 90 minutes on just my case alone.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, they did reenactments mixed with straight interviews of everybody involved. Me, the rest of the crew, the sheriff and his deputy, and the doctor who took care of me after I was returned, and the state police lie detector expert. You know, they were very thorough, and there was no, like, narration or voiceover. It was just straight interview, people telling it from their point of view. And so it was... really the most accurate piece
that's been done. Well, that's, have you, just curious, have you been able to, like, also have a pretty normal life as well, you know?
I really work at that, you know. I'll go out, like, this last weekend I was speaking in Roswell. The weekend before that I was doing an interview with Russian television. But when I come home, I just try to, you know, block that out of my mind and live a normal life as much as possible. It's probably why I turned down so many radio interviews, is that I just have to get away from it at times, you know.
Well, no, I'm happy to talk to you because, you know, you're just a regular guy, and you had an experience, and you're talking about it, and I think it's important.
Somewhere here something good should come of it. You know, I'm talking about in terms of benefit to humanity, to, you know, the world at large.
Well, I think, and what was new to hearing you in this conversation tonight was that I didn't realize that they actually were trying to help you, you know, and they're actually kind of looking after you, these beings that took you in. And maybe they are trying to help the planet, you know, not destroy itself as well, you know.
Yeah, you know, if when the crew describes that beam hitting me, the violence and the power of that energy, you know, once they got away a certain distance, Dwayne Smith says to Steve, you know, it looked like he disintegrated.
Wow.
And Steve goes, no, I saw him hit the ground in one piece. But that's how devastating that energy was. So, you know, the idea that, you know, I might have been, you know, killed is not a big stretch, because that's what they believed the minute that thing hit me, that they thought they just seen somebody get killed.
Wait, so they took off after that? They didn't?
Yeah, they figured they were next.
Oh, that's why they took off. Oh.
Yeah, so, you know, when they saw it leave, they figured it was safe to come back. But still, that took a lot of courage to come back at all.
So they came back to look for you, and you were not there. Then what did they think about that?
Well, then they had to go to the talk to get help. You know, some of them were against reporting it to the authorities until they'd gotten some, you know, their own search going. But they figured that, you know, if I was never found, that it would look bad if they didn't report it to the law enforcement. So when the sheriff and his men came, they could see plainly that something really devastating had happened. These guys were shaken, and some of them were still crying. But they immediately suspected that it was just a cover-up for a murder.
And what would they think the reason for murdering you? What would it be? Why would they want to do that?
Well, just, you know, fight. A bunch of guys. I mean, we did get in fights, you know, with me and Alan and Alan and Mike. And, you know, we're loggers, you know, a bunch of hard-ass guys. That, you know, and so it was easy to think, you know, maybe there was a fight and maybe a chainsaw got involved and somebody wound up dying.
I see. You know, and that happens. It could happen, but, yeah.
So the sheriff looks at these guys, yeah, that's a kind of a rough bunch, you know.
Right. But when your crew went back to the site where you got knocked out and you weren't there, did they think that the ship had taken you or that you disintegrated? Or they didn't know?
They were wondering if maybe I came to and tried to find them, you know, that maybe I wandered off in a daze. So that's the reason they spent 5 days. The sheriff's posse had over 50 men searching the area, you know, airplanes, helicopters, tracking dogs.
It's so incredible in a way, isn't it? I mean,
well, even my oldest brother thought they might have killed me, and he was out there, you know, looking through the brush piles that the crew had made, thinking that my body was hidden in there.
So when you returned 5 days later, were they just overjoyed to see you, your crew and your family?
Well, my family was certainly overjoyed. The crew, you know, a lot of people assumed that we were just like this group of buddies that hung out together. But, you know, we were just a bunch of people who happened to be working in the same place. You know, you go home at night and you live your own life. So we weren't a bunch of friends. We were, but I imagine they were extremely relieved that I was alive and the suspicion of murder. They were under a lot of pressure from the community. Just driving down the street, people would yell out at them, "Murderer!" and that kind of stuff, you know.
Wow.
So, and there was some hostility from my family towards the crew, wondering if they had done something.
But now you guys must be pretty close because you've been through so much together.
No, we were together for the job, and then when the job blew up because of what happened, everybody went their separate ways. Now, Steve showed up here a couple years ago, and, you know, he'd been hiding out for all those years, didn't want nothing to do with it, but now he's out there speaking about it, and it wasn't until just this last month that I was finally, after 20 years, able to locate Dwayne Smith. So
you hadn't seen him since the incident?
No, 20 years. I talked to him on the phone. Haven't really seen him since right after the incident, but I talked to him on the phone back in 93 or thereabouts. But
what's he saying now about the whole thing, Dwayne?
He says he's willing to come out and start talking about it, but he just, you know, he'd see things on TV and he never felt the need to say anything. I don't know. I think for some of them, the stigma was so heavy. It was easier for them to just go about their lives and not say anything.
Yeah.
You know, John would be at some place and people would start talking about it, and he wouldn't say, "Oh, that was me, I was there." And as a matter of fact, some people would brag that they were on that crew. So, of course, Steve knew they weren't. They were just saying this. And he just sat there while they told the story about how well they knew us. And this has happened to several guys on the crew, to hear people claiming that they worked with us or knew us and something like that. And somebody who actually was on the crew is standing right there listening to them. They don't even know it. So there was a lot of that going on. But, you know, they were able to kind of go under the radar and not have it bother them as much. So now that I've, you know, fought the skeptics all these years and have, you know, broken trail, they're a little more willing to come out and speak about it.
Right. So you sort of became a legend among the loggers, huh, in a way?
Well... Yeah, willingly or unwillingly, I guess.
Did you continue to do logging though after the whole thing?
I had to go back to the woods. It's, you know, you get thrown off the horse, you got to get back on, or you know, it's kicked your butt. So I went back and I worked even alone in the woods. You know, I admit that I went armed, but I did have to do it just to, you know, feel,
right,
you know, back on my feet.
How much after was that time? When did you return to the woods?
Not too long.
Oh, like just a couple of months or something?
Well, I don't really, you know, I haven't ever figured that out. But eventually I just, you know, quit that and went to work at the molding mill, worked there for 6 or 7 years, and then I worked at the paper mill for 11 years.
And now what are you doing now?
Well, I took retirement, and then because I could see the writing on the wall, and sure enough, they shut that paper mill down after 60 years. You know, other than my pension from that, I'm just...
You must make something from speaking at some of these events, don't you?
Yeah.
That's pretty good. I mean, to travel the world and just talk about your experiences.
Well, you know, it's nothing that ever made anybody rich, but it, you know, makes it possible to do.
Right. I'm just curious, and then we'll just kind of wrap up, but because thank you for your time. But did you ever see anything like that, or any guys on the crew ever see another ship like that?
I imagine everybody seen things at times and probably paid more attention to it because of what happened to us. But, you know, when you get right down to it, even people who say they don't believe it, if you push them, they will admit that they have seen something that might have been something that extraordinary. You know, and you say, well, did you ever report it? And they'll usually say no.
Well, what have you seen since 1975 that you might think was like that?
Well, you know, if I had something happen, even as dramatic as what happened, I don't know that I would come public with it. Like I said, I was forced to at the time, and it really destroyed my life. So,
I know.
Oh, you know, and something else. Back then, the skeptics were attacking the whole thing because I had a brother that had seen something about 8 years before. And, you know, that's really kind of a silly basis. But the theory at that time, even amongst ufologists that believed in UFOs, that if you were a, quote, repeater, that was less credible. Nowadays, people are always saying, what? You haven't had lifelong abductions your whole life? That doesn't fit the pattern. So, you know, things have really reversed in that sense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the surveys show that 1 out of 7 people have seen something.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was from a family of 7 and a crew of 7. The idea that somebody would have seen something before was not some suspicious situation. It was an overwhelming likelihood. Almost, you know, huge numbers of people have seen things.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I mean, movies, there's been films, videos, photographs as well. But did you ever see anything else after that was pretty odd?
We took a picture of this silvery orb in the daytime sky at work in the woods, took it in and enlarged it, and it was a weather balloon.
Oh, let's see. Well, there you go. Those weather balloons really do exist.
Yeah.
But you haven't seen like another, or, but probably, you know, I guess you'd be more prepared. You know, because out in Joshua Tree, there's that UFO rock. There used to be gatherings there in the 50s, right outside of Joshua Tree. Do you know about that?
What was that? It was called Giant Rock or something.
Yeah, Giant Rock, exactly. There were all these UFO gatherings. George Adamski and the guy who built the Integratron. There were thousands of people would gather out there in the 50s waiting for some kind of craft to show up at this giant rock. It would be a great trip out there when you're out in Joshua Tree to just check it out and see what you think.
Is the Integratron still there?
Yes, the Integratron built by George Van Tassel. Yeah, it's still there. You can go in. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. What do you know about that?
No, I just heard about it.
Well, it's supposed to conduct an interesting energy field because there's no metal. There's no metal nails, nothing. It's all wood, and it's supposed to generate its own frequency. And, yeah, that's right about a mile from Giant Rock, which is just really a few miles from the Joshua Tree Retreat Center. So,
I had no idea there was any proximity at all.
What
are they planning on having tours go out there or something?
I think they were going to, I think, talk to Victoria, who's, you know, running it. But, yeah, I think she was going to have a tour out to Giant Rock. What day are you showing up? Do you know?
I don't remember. I'd have to look at the schedule. But, you know, I think this is a really a major event. There's a whole lot of people coming together at one time here. I think it's going to be, you know, quite an event.
Yeah, I think so. Let me just tell people who's going to be there, who's going to the website. Richard Doland, I mentioned. Jim Mars, who I think I'll have on this program next week, who's great at exposing the cover-up. Let's see, who else? Stephen Greer, who just did that movie, Sirius. Did you hear about that movie where they...
No, I heard about it just a little while ago. Somebody sent me an email about it.
Yeah, he finds this little being in the desert in Chile, and they do all this kind of DNA testing. Of course, George Noory from Coast to Coast, I think he's probably one of the most popular people. Giorgio Tsoukalos from Ancient Aliens. You know that program, Ancient Aliens?
Yeah, I was on there, opening episode of Season 5.
Mm-hmm. He's going to be there. Michael Sala, who's an investigator. William Henry. Let's see. Oh, Roger Lear, who's does extractions of implants that people.
Yeah.
Have you met up with Roger at all, Roger Lear?
Yeah, I've met most of these people.
Oh yeah, yeah. So I think you're right. I think it is going to be a very significant event, and I'll be there as well. So. I'll get a chance to say hello. Maybe we could do an on-camera interview. I do a cable show as well. And what do you know? When are you giving a talk and a workshop there, or do you know what the?
Yeah, I think so. I'd have to look. I'd have to look at the schedule, but you know, I'm pretty sure that's the way we're doing that.
All right, great. And then I'm going to host the alien abduction panel on Sunday with a bunch of people. Talking about
am I on that panel?
Well, you should be, of course. I mean, of course, you weren't abducted, but you still. I'll check. I mean, I think you should be on that panel.
I really don't care for panels. I was on one this last weekend in Roswell.
Oh, really? Who was on that panel with you in Roswell?
Yvonne Smith, Daryl Sims.
What did you think of Daryl Sims' ideas?
My problem with panels is because everybody up there had a different take, and it
right.
seems a little bit conflicting. You know, it was confusing for the audience. That was some of the remarks that they were.
Well, but if you're saying there's all these different types of beings, and you know. All these people have their own experience. I mean, I understand how it could be confusing, but also it's a subjective experience as well. People will have, different types of experiences. I mean, what I try to do, hosting a panel, is try to look for the common ground that, you know, we can agree upon.
Right. That would be the kind of... goal that a panel would have is to find some consensus or thread of agreement that they would all, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's, all right. I mean, I'll see you out there. And
yeah, we'll see you there. So
thanks for your time here. I really appreciate you opening up and, you know, spending a little time talking about your experiences because it's so important that, you know, you come forward in the real, sober, matter-of-fact fashion style that you are, you know?
Like, yeah, I think it's important. You know, sometimes I'll say something at conferences that isn't all that well received, you know.
like what?
Well, what I say is, you know, instead of thinking this is some kind of quasi-supernatural or, you know, kind of a monster story, you don't look at it that way. It's just those people from way over there that we don't know very much about. And it's like a lead balloon, you know. I don't know. It lets the air out of some people. They seem like they want to think of it that way. But I'll tell you what, you know, it took me decades to kind of come to that sort of understanding.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. But I think the trauma that they do exist over there and that they are so different yet in a way so similar to us is what people can't get their heads around in a sense.
Yeah.
And that's because we've been so limited in who we think we are.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when the various explorers went to other cultures around the planet, they would often be greeted in ways to where they thought they were devils or gods or something. And it's because they didn't understand the difference in their ways and the difference in their appearance.
Right.
And so we're falling into the same trap of you know, viewing them in a kind of a quasi-supernatural kind of a perspective that's probably not warranted, you know?
No, I agree, absolutely. They are just maybe just more evolved than us, and because of that, they have a different perspective on the universe and a greater technology, but they're... I don't think they're different from us in fundamental ways. You know?
You're right, but not in a way that's going to turn out to be mundane. I think there'll be plenty of amazing surprises along the way. But
well,
still,
what do you think would be so surprising?
Well, you know, obviously, you know, differences. I think you know what's going to be the most surprising thing for people is the similarities, not just between us and them. Between all us and all the forms of life on their planets. I think rather than, you know, science fiction, Hollywood take on things that there's all these exotic forms, for the most part, we're going to be astonished at how similar life on other worlds is to life here. Now, I know there'll be some amazing creatures, and we find amazing creatures here, you know, but for the most part, the main part is just how similar the life forms are going to be.
Yeah,
mark my words.
I agree. yeah, thank you for that. But I do think what will be amazing is the way they think about reality. I'm sort of writing about that. How they see the world. You know, like your dog may see the world one way, and then you know your dog doesn't know what you're doing on the computer. I think that's the difference between who we are and these advanced races. I think their intelligence and their capacity for awareness is vastly beyond what we can comprehend. And I think that's really the trauma involved in these interactions, is that we can't
because
understand.
Because the unknown always winds up being fearful, you know, threatening to
us. Yeah, it's true. And we need to embrace the unknown if we're, and I'm going to evolve. And I think this whole interaction with these beings is about the, it's where we are in our evolution.
Yeah. And, well, we're getting there, and I'm hope to help in the process.
And you definitely are. Thank you, Travis.
All right.
Your
well,
time.
Good night, and I'll see you in Joshua Tree.
I'll see you out in Joshua Tree. Have a good night, and thanks for doing the interview. And I'll send you an email about where this will be posted. Okay.
All right. Good night.
Okay. Good night. I've been talking to Travis Walton, and for people who aren't familiar with him, I still recommend Fire in the Sky, which is a movie made about his experiences in 1975 with a crew of loggers in the woods of Arizona, probably one of the most dramatic cases of encounters with these
Well, if they
people.
Would like to contact me, they can do that or even order a book through my website, and that's TravisWalton.com.
Okay, TravisWalton.com. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to newrealities.com or email me at newrealities.com. Thanks for listening. And don't forget, go to the Joshua Tree Retreat Center, Contact in the Desert, August 9th to the 11th. You can look up Joshua Tree Retreat Center. You go to my website, newrealities.com. There's a banner there. Actually, if you enter, there's a contest for 2 free tickets. If you go to that website, look up the Contact in the Desert, and you can enter a sweepstakes and win 2 free tickets to the conference. If not, I recommend it anyway. It's going to be an amazing gathering of the top researchers in the field and people who've experienced these things. And I think it's going to change the paradigm for a lot of people who may not be aware of the level of contact we've already been involved in. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week. Good night.